This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Heatwave moves, can't escape the heat. Dancing in the sun on burning concrete. Heatwave moves, no relief in sight. Dangerous days and sweltering nights.
Over 900 worshippers died of heat when it went over 50 degrees C, 122 Fahrenheit, in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, during the Hajj. During weeks of long extreme heat, domes over India, Mexico, North Africa, and the Middle East, nobody counted the dead. Only Europeans and North Americans matter to big media. Around the world, people died silently in record extreme heat, unreported. In this show, after an extreme weather update, we revisit urban heat survival tips with Professor Matt Santamouris. Then Dr. Anders Leverman from Potsdam University reminds us more people are displaced by river floods than any other extreme event.
Look up to the sky, hope for a breeze, wish for a cloud, bringing in some ease. Turn on the news, hear the weatherman, says more heat to come, hold on if you can.
By some estimates, at least 900 people died of the heat during the religious Hajj in Saudi Arabia. The final total may be higher. Hundreds of bodies filled the morgue in Mecca. The heat reached 51.8 degrees C, 125 Fahrenheit, setting a new record for Mecca. By tradition and religious duty, millions of men and a few women walked through open avenues to various sites of outdoor worship in the relentless sun. Dead bodies were filmed on the streets of Mecca. The Saudi authorities did try. They set up a registration system and built air-conditioned tents for those registered. They tried to clear away about 100,000 worshippers, they say, who were not registered, but countless more showed up. Some avenues had giant spray nozzles overhead. They tried, and they died in the holy place. At some point, adaptation is not possible. The only real solution? Reduce oil production by about 20% a year and end production by 2030. Humanity, of course, is doing the opposite. According to the Energy Institute, the world burned more oil, gas, and coal than ever before. Let that sink in. Fossil fuel burning increased 2.1% over the previous year, which was already a record high. One tally says 40 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide were added to the atmosphere. The real tally, including methane, nitrous oxide, and other warming gases, was much higher. In 2023, humans broke another barrier, burning more than 100 million barrels a day of oil alone. 100 million barrels a day. The United States increased production by 8%. Clean energy, like solar and wind, are being added at faster rates, but those gains are just being added to the fossil energy pile as demand grows, especially in developing nations. Despite installing more than half of all the new alternative energy last year, fossil fuel burning by China rose 6%. India consumed 8% more fossil fuels and used more coal than North America and Europe combined. In Greece, as you know, tourists went out and died in more record-smashing heat. A friend in Greece writes saying, despite growing up with heat, now for the first time, he fears summer. At one point, the fire chief in Attica said new fires broke out almost every 10 minutes. In Athens, Greece shut its primary tourist attraction, the Acropolis, as well as schools, for 43 degrees C heat, 109 degrees Fahrenheit. That isn't the feels-like index. That's the temperature. Heat records were broken across the Middle East and China. In Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan, it is too hot to work. But many must, or families will go hungry. As meteorologist Scott Duncan reports, brutal heat, New Delhi, India, just recorded its hottest night on record at the observatory since 1901. The heat wave has been rewriting many records. New Delhi has hit 40 degrees C or greater for 37 consecutive days now, end quote from Scott Duncan. Temperature guru Herrera posted on his Twitter site on June the 19th, quote, currently 156 countries are breaking heat records these hours. This is 250% more than any full month before mid-2023. June 2024 is breaking about double of the station records than May 2024, the most record-breaking month in history. This is one of a kind, end quote. It has been deadly hot in Mexico for weeks, an absolute record heat over the Caribbean islands. But now heat finally arrives in North America. Now it gets reported. 98 degrees Fahrenheit in Boston? Ooh, they're not ready for that. The first named tropical storm of the season slammed into Mexico, but the U.S. media only reports flooding in Texas. Silence about their neighbors and major trade partners during the damaging storm. A soggy low with floods and erosion is predicted in a three-week extreme rain event over Central America. With an early heat dome like this, there may be more deaths in the U.S. Northeast, and particularly New England, because, well, fewer people have air conditioning, cities there are less prepared for extreme heat, and the first blast of heat every year is often the most deadly. People are caught off guard. In areas where heat is uncommon, people have a lower tolerance as well. For example, as we hear from Matt Santamouris in a coming segment, with temperatures over 90 degrees, 32 degrees C, they're common in Greece, but in England, when the heat gets up to just 85 Fahrenheit or 29 C, people start showing up in emergency rooms with heat effects. Extreme heat continues in Africa, far beyond the seasonal norms anyone expects. More records in the Sahel, including in Sudan, where about 5 million people are huddled in makeshift tent home camps as almost permanent refugees. They are hungry and inordinately hot. It does not cool down below body temperature at night. It's not reported. Nobody cares. Personally, I feel guilt and shame that we are causing this suffering for simple people so far away. They got few or no benefits at all from the fossil burning boom. Meanwhile, here's a Canadian news item. Canadians plan more destination weddings. Yeah, let's fly 50 people to Fiji. We'll do it for fun and for love and for memories, and we will ruin the future for our kids. We make other people suffer for our pointless travels, wasted energy, and frenetic driving of gas-guzzling cars. We are fossil sadists. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. The way downtown cities are built, extreme heat may drive you out. It's pretty close to that right now in Darwin, Australia, where temperatures up to 70 degrees C, an astounding 158 degrees Fahrenheit, have been measured in certain places in the central business district. It doesn't have to be that way. We can go a long way towards adapting urban heat islands into something much more livable. Our next guest is an expert in that. Professor Matt Santamouris is currently Professor of High Performance Architecture in the University of New South Wales in Australia, but he's a global guy as a Professor of Energy Physics at the University of Athens and visiting professor at times at universities in London, Tokyo, Italy, and Singapore. Matt is editor-in-chief of the journal Energy and Buildings. He's the author and editor of 14 books on heat islands, solar energy, and energy conservation in buildings. Good stuff. He's published over 180 peer-reviewed papers. Matt Santamouris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Well, this is a good time to be talking about heat where you are. What was the weather like in Australia?
We had a very serious heat wave last, January and February, where in Western Sydney we had temperatures close to 45 degrees for more than a week.
Well, I interview a lot of scientists about the rise in global mean temperatures, but you're looking at the extremes hitting urban areas right now. Why is it important to look at very local temperatures as well?
Because, local temperature affect the quality of life, of people. Once you have very high temperatures, you have a tremendous impact on energy, you have a tremendous impact on morbidity and mortality, on comfort and health, on peak electricity demand, on cooling demand, on everything. So peak demand and peak temperatures really define the quality of life. Average temperature, it doesn't really show something, because you may have a low temperature during the night, you may have a very high temperature during the day, so what? It's very important to understand really how is the temperature during the daytime and how is the temperature during the nighttime and which are the characteristics of the variation of the temperature during the day.
Now, the city of Darwin is on the north coast of Australia. It's expected to be hot. It is tropical. But have there been some recent studies done about what is happening in their downtown area, or as they would call it, the central business district?
Yes, we have monitored the whole area. And we have, collected a lot of data about the ambient temperature and the surface temperature in the CBD area of Darwin. And we have then developed some monitoring, some mitigation technologies and mitigation scenarios in order to decrease the temperature. And actually, we try to implement all these new technologies downtown Darwin. The surface temperature, as you mentioned before, was very high because of the use of non-appropriate materials, for example, bitumen parking loads and many other things, that presented, surface temperatures up to 70 degrees Celsius, while the ambient temperature was about, 3 to 4 degrees higher than in the surrounding area. So the intensity of the urban heat island in Darwin was about 3 to 4 degrees, and this had a tremendous impact on energy, on mortality, on morbidity, on comfort and everything.
Yes, people die earlier because of extreme heat. We've been doing a series on that on Radio EcoShock. Now, in April 2017, you co-authored a paper titled Mortality Associated with High Ambient Temperatures, Heat Waves, and the Urban Heat Island in Athens, Greece. Please tell us what you found there.
It is well known that, mortality, heat-related mortality, is very much associated with, the peak temperature. And in many places in the world, we have found that, it follows a U-shaped curve. And the higher the temperature, the higher, the mortality. There is a threshold temperature over which mortality is increasing almost exponentially. And this threshold temperature is not the same for every place. For example, for Athens, it is close to 32.5 degrees because people there is adapted to high temperatures. But in London, it's close to 23 degrees. So in every place, there is a threshold temperature over which heat-related mortality is increasing really exponentially or very highly. So what we found in Athens was that once the temperature exceeds, the threshold, 32 degrees, mortality is increasing really very rapidly. And this is a major problem because it affects the vulnerable population, it affects the aged people, it affects, children, it affects those that they are living in non-proper houses, low-income people. And this is, a social penalty imposed, to those that they cannot really afford to have air conditioning the whole day at home.
Well, it's partly cultural then, and whether people are already adapted or expecting heat, but there's also the factor of the humidity in the weather. Isn't that important as far as mortality goes?
It is. It is very important. Humidity is very important. It plays a very important role. Humidity in Athens is not so high, so humidity is not the major problem in Athens. But in other places, for example, in Darwin, humidity is a major problem. So the combination of humidity with, the ambient temperature can be, very, very important and may define the levels of heat-related mortality. But, all the studies that we have from all the, the last heat waves around the world has also shown that outdoor pollution and indoor pollution, but mainly outdoor pollution in combination with high temperature and humidity may, create a very fatal cocktail, for the human beings.
On November 27th at news.com in Australia, they published some very revealing heat photos. I liked them. There was a rooftop parking lot that was off the charts hot. While a nearby lot with a large tree was a lot cooler, how can planting help cool off our cities, Matt?
Greenery makes a lot because greenery, you know, offers evapotranspiration and decreases temperature in our cities. And at the same time, you know, because of shading and many other functions of greenery, may help a lot to decrease temperatures and mitigate urban heat island and improve comfort conditions. Greenery is one of the best mitigation technologies we may apply. Also, we have to understand that greenery is very effective after a certain temperature. Above a threshold, greenery is not producing any more evapotranspiration because it has to be protected. It has to protect the water, you know, of the tree. And in this case, you know, greenery is not really responding to the mitigation. So greenery is a very effective and very, let's say, important mitigation technologies that may help at a certain, let's say, temperature. Above this temperature, greenery cannot help a lot. And this is the reason that in many parks during heat waves, temperature is higher than outside the parks.
And there's been a lot of talk of painting roofs white to reflect more of the sun's energy. You published an article in September 2017 on reflective geoengineering technologies in cities. Matt Santamouris, please tell us about that.
Yeah, we have developed some reflective technologies for pavements and roofs. Reflective technologies that really help to decrease the surface temperature of the pavements and decrease the ambient temperature. We have more than 200, applications all around the world, and we have seen that the use of reflective pavements of high technology may reduce, the surface temperature up to 15 degrees and at the same time decrease the ambient temperature up to 2 to 2.5 degrees. This is very important because it may decrease the cooling load of buildings up to 60-70%, decrease the heat-related mortality by about 60-70% as well, and also decrease the peak electricity demand by 5-6% in the city, and also improve the comfort levels. This is a very mature technology. Actually, we're working with the development of more efficient, pavement technologies using some very advanced materials, and we hope that in the next 5 years we will be able to decrease the ambient temperature up to 4 or 5 degrees.
Wait a minute. If we just change the way we build things and the way we pave things, we could reduce mortality by about 60% and save about 60% on the energy use of buildings?
Energy use for cooling and the heat-related mortality, not mortality in general.
Right. Well, that's still an amazing amount. We should get going on that.
Of course. So the recent study we have performed for Western Sydney, it shows that in the northwestern part of the city, where temperature is to about 9 degrees higher than in the eastern part of the city, the application of advanced mitigation technologies may reduce the peak temperature up to 2.5 degrees, but at the same time decrease, the heat-related mortality by about 90%. Just to understand that in the eastern part of the city, heat-related mortality is close to 7, deaths per 100,000 inhabitants. In the western part of the city, maybe close to 14. Application of, mitigation, advanced mitigation technologies may reduce heat-related mortality down to 7, which is, a decrease close to 90%. So it is really very important. And in my opinion, you know, the main problem and the main issue we will face in the future is really health and not so much energy. Energy is important, but we know how really to face the energy problems. Health is going to be the major issue in the next years.
Well, of course, the real solution is, as you say, to slash our greenhouse gas emissions. And I see you're involved in a project called Zero Plus. The longer title sounds really exciting, Achieving Near Zero and Positive Energy Settlements in Europe Using Advanced Energy Technology. How do you envision these Zero Plus settlements in Europe?
This is a very prestigious project. This is the flagship of the European Union, and I'm very happy to be the coordinator of this project. This project aims to design and also, build 4 zero energy settlements, one in Cyprus, one in Italy, one in France, and one in the UK. Actually, we have, finalized the design, and 2 out of the 4 settlements are under construction, and we expect that by the beginning of the next year, the construction will start in the other, sites. And by, 2019, all the settlements will be ready. This is a major, let's say, issue because actually we know a lot about, let's say, zero-energy buildings, and we have optimized zero-energy buildings. But we have found that zero-energy buildings increase a bit the cost, you know, of the residential or the office buildings in general. So the best way, really, to integrate renewables and energy conservation technologies in the building sector is to have, let's say, a community-integrated renewable and energy efficiency technologies than building-integrated technologies. Once the renewable technologies and the energy efficiency technologies are integrated at the community level, the cost is much lower, the management is much better, and the performance is also, let's say, much better. So this is a win-win situation. This is what we have designed, and this is what we implement, actually, in the four, let's say, settlements. And we expect to have all the monitoring results, the first monitoring results, by the end of the next year.
Matt, could you tell us where one of these zero settlements are so we can look them up on the Internet?
Yeah, there's a site, Zero Energy Zero Plus Program. You may, let's say, Google Zero Plus, and you will find the site. And all information is there.
Okay. You know, you just reminded me that back, I think it was in 2010, I broadcast a workshop by the Austrian zero emissions architect Guido Wimmers, and he's designed countless net zero buildings in Europe, from apartment buildings to schools and municipal offices, and some of them never even had to turn on a furnace or an air conditioner, even in Austria. It makes me wonder why we don't mandate net zero buildings for new construction, say in Australia, in the United States, in Canada, where we need them.
In Europe, it is mandatory. Since 2018, all the public buildings, and since 2020, all new private buildings have to be zero energy or almost zero energy buildings. So it is mandatory in Europe. In Australia, I think that the quality of the building, let's say construction, is not the best possible, and a lot of things have to happen. Perhaps of the climate, perhaps for many other reasons. Energy protection and the energy consumption of buildings has not taken really the proper attention. I think that there is a huge potential for improvement, and this is something that has to happen here. In Canada, I think that actually the level of knowledge about zero-energy buildings is very high. I know that there is a wonderful work that is happening actually in the University of Concordia in Montreal. I know that there are many, many zero-energy buildings. I think that this is not a technical problem. The knowledge is there. It is more, let's say, a commercial problem. It is, let's say, more a policy problem if, let's say, the governments would like really to invest in it and push, let's say, the country towards such a direction.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with Professor Matt Santamouris from the University of New South Wales in Sydney. And extreme city heat is getting pretty important. It's uncomfortable for people in those urban heat sinks. It can be deadly. I'm wondering, Matt, can we just keep air conditioning everything so we arrive by an air-conditioned car, we get out into air-conditioned buildings? We're making these technical cool bubbles to stay alive as long as the power stays on, but there must be limits to how much we can do.
There are some limits, for sure. Depends, you know, on the magnitude of the problem. Once, you know, the ambient temperature is, let's say, very close to the temperature of the human body, yes, we have many alternatives, and we may, let's say, avoid the use of air conditioning, and we may apply some passive cooling techniques, and we may reduce substantially the use of air conditioning. Once the ambient temperature, indoor or outdoor, is close to the body temperature, we may apply several passive cooling techniques, and we may, let's say, avoid the use of air conditioning. Actually, we have designed buildings with almost a zero energy consumption for cooling, or very, very low energy consumption for cooling. So, yes, it is possible. But on the other hand, once temperature exceeds a certain threshold, for example, during heat waves, you may have 45 degrees, 46 degrees, adaptation is very difficult. And although the quality of the building may reduce the cooling needs, let's say up to 60, 70, 80%, depends on the quality of the building, human beings cannot really afford to live under these conditions for a long period. So air conditioning is absolutely necessary. In this case, we need some technical adaptation measures to protect the population, and especially the vulnerable population. We don't have alternatives, you know, for such a range of temperatures. We can really avoid the use of air conditioners up to 35, 34, 35 degrees, and it's not so simple, but we can do that. But once the temperature is much higher than the temperature of the human body, then we don't have enough of alternatives really to protect human beings.
Matt, the latest paper you co-authored is called Aerial Survey and In-Situ Measurements of Materials and Vegetation in the Urban Fabric. I'm wondering, how do you do this? What tools do you use to really find out what the heat is in cities?
We're using drones. We have designed and developed some drones that they may, let's say, record information in the visible, say, spectrum about the surface temperature and the ambient temperature in the cities. Both in Athens and in Sydney, we're using some sophisticated drones, and these drones are following some energy buses which are equipped with some antennas going up to 20 meters where all the possible instruments have been placed, so we can measure all the, let's say, characteristics of the ambient temperature, and at the same time with the drone, the characteristics of the surface temperature, and so have a very good knowledge of what is happening, you know, in the urban environment. Monitoring and diagnostic tools are extremely important if we like really to offer solutions for our cities. If we don't do that, unfortunately, we don't have the proper information and we risk it to solve the wrong problem. We may apply, let's say, technologies that are not really the better technology or the best technologies to solve the problem. So it is very, very important to understand the nature of the problem, the characteristics of the problem through proper diagnostic techniques, and then design and apply the proper mitigation technologies.
Are cities starting to apply these adaptation techniques? Where are we now in this process?
Depends on the city. In Europe, actually, there are some adaptation measures and some emergency measures trying really to offer the proper, let's say, adaptation policies to people that cannot really afford to have an air conditioner at home or their vulnerable population, etc. So they open some, let's say, sport facilities, air conditioning sport facilities. They offer air conditioning transport, many, many things. And this really may save lives. But the more important is not there. The most important, in my opinion, is really to have a global policy to improve the quality of the built environment. It is extremely important to improve the quality of our cities, improve the quality of our, let's say, buildings. So it is very, very significant, you know, first of all, to avoid the overheating of our cities and to use the proper materials, use greenery, use water, use some sophisticated mitigation technologies. We are able to decrease the peak temperature of our cities up to 3 degrees. In the next years, we'll be able to decrease temperature up to 4 or 5 degrees. These technologies have to be implemented. We have already many, many examples, more than 200 implementations all around the world, very successful. At the same time, we have all the technology, all the knowledge to improve the quality of our buildings, decrease the energy consumption, provide comfort, have a better air quality. So this is, in my opinion, one of the highest priority. And it's not just a priority that will, let's say, improve the quality of living, which is very important. But on the other hand, we'll create huge opportunities for employment, huge opportunities, you know, for further developments. Will be a new, let's say, financial opportunity for the whole world. So retrofitting of our cities, retrofitting of our buildings, in my opinion, is one of the major, let's say, opportunities, and is a win-win, let's say, situation.
We have been talking with Professor Mateos Santamouris. He teaches at several universities, including Athens right now. He's with the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. And I'll put links to some of Matt's papers and his bio and the new science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
My town is on fire. Accelerator, watch this rain hit the accelerator. The
place is underwater, but you say hit the accelerator.